The title of this talk was inspired by the environmental activist and writer Terry Tempest Williams. Just curious, how many people know of her work or have read her? She's wonderful. So she has a book that I love, which is Finding Beauty in a Broken World. And I've been so moved by her writing and her thinking. Again, this is sort of a co-creation, as we say. I'm calling it The Power of Compassion, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. So let me just give you a little background as to why I'm here, and no pun intended, sort of the roots of this talk. So I grew up in a rather eccentric family, and I started meditating in elementary school. And the way this happened was that my aunt was a journalist in New York City. I'm dating myself, but this was the mid-60s, and she was sent on assignment to study the first Swami who opened an ashram in New York City. And she started meditating and doing yoga, and it really clicked for her. And then she came, it was the summer, to visit her mother, who was my grandmother, and her sister, who was my mother. And she taught the entire family to meditate and to yoga. And, you know, my mother thought it was weird, and my father thought it was weird, and my brother thought it was very bizarre. But something about it clicked for me. So whenever there was a school vacation, I grew up in Boston, I would go visit my aunt. And she was a serious journalist. So whenever there was a story, she would go for it. And that was how she approached spirituality. So whenever I'd come and visit, she'd say, "Oh, there's a great guru in town, I have to take you." Or, "There's a great Zen master." Or, "There's Sufi dancing." Or, "There's a Tibetan master." Or, "There's a Sikh master." Or, "A Tibetan master." So most of my childhood was spent, at least, you know, visiting her, being taken from teacher to teacher to teacher. And I remember I was taken to Ram Dass, I was taken to Krishnamurti, so it was a very colorful childhood. And with a background like this, of course, I ended up studying comparative religion. But what happened, and unfortunately this hasn't really changed, is it's felt like every community there was some scandal. And it was one after another after another. And I wish I could say, oh, that ended in the 70s, or that ended in the 80s. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And I remember really having a crisis of faith. It was like, wait a minute, what is going on here? These teachers claim that they're enlightened beings. You know, why are they sleeping with their students? Why are they stealing? What is all this unethical behavior? And at that point, I'd gone on for a master's degree in comparative religion, and I was sort of set to be, you know, a serious scholar. Only, you know, I wasn't very good in linguistics, and Sanskrit was more than I could handle. And also, there were, you know, no jobs to speak of. And there still aren't. And I got very interested in trauma and abuse, and I made this pivot into psychology because I wanted to make sense of what was happening. And luckily, I found some visionary women mentors. This was late 70s, early 80s. And this was really the beginning of feminist psychology, as well as the beginning of really understanding trauma. And trauma then wasn't a word that was known. I mean, you'd say, I'm interested in trauma, and people thought you're talking about a car accident. I mean, it was medical trauma then. It wasn't understanding anything really about sexual abuse or taking advantage of others. And as I was then making this pivot to studying psychology, I got myself into therapy, and I thought, oh, you know, this is good work. This is a good thing to be doing with one's life. And I remember just starting out, not knowing what I was doing, and Jack Kornfield has a phrase that I like, which is, we were all doing this without adult supervision. And I really was not knowing what I was doing, and of course not wanting to cause any harm. And one of my first cases was with a very angry adolescent. And she really was intent on putting me down. So whenever I said anything, she would let me know it was stupid, that I was incompetent, that I was green, that I was a baby therapist. I mean, she was really insulting. So, you know, sometimes in life, not only do you feel stupid or you're like an idiot or you're incompetent or you're an imposter, she confirmed all of that for me. That indeed I was an idiot, I was incompetent, I was stupid, I didn't say the right thing. It was really tough. And then finally, I just hit a wall with her. I didn't know what else to do. And at that point, I was just starting out. I wasn't well trained. I didn't have a toolbox. And I just stopped and I thought, okay, what would I do? And I thought, well, okay, let me try some meditation here with her. Because at that point, I'd had decades of meditating with different teachers. So I tried just a very simple, at that point we didn't even call it mindfulness, we called it meditation. I tried a very simple meditation practice. And something shifted for her. And she kind of quieted down. She sort of liked that. She said, oh, now that actually helped. So I thought, oh, okay. And then again, I didn't know what I was doing, and I went to one of my supervisors, because when you're in training, even if you're not in training as a therapist, you're supposed to get supervision so you don't cause any harm and you get some guidance. So I went to my supervisor, who was this kind of scary older woman, and I said to her, taking a real risk, you know, can I ask you a question? I'd like to start bringing some meditation into the therapy practice. And she was an old guard, probably analyst. And she looked at me horrified. And I wish I had bifocals, but imagine I have bifocals, okay? So she looked down her nose at me, froze me with her stare. I don't know if she put her hands on her hips, but imagine that she put her hands on her hips. And she said, in one of the iciest voices I'd ever heard, Susan, I'm trying to give you a patrician Boston Brahmin accent here, you can do what you like behind closed doors, but I will not supervise you on it. So I was totally ashamed, silenced, really embarrassed. And, of course, silenced. So I felt totally humbled. And, of course, now, you know, all these books and teachers trying to bring mindfulness into psychotherapy, there's all this research showing that it helps with anxiety and depression and trauma and relationships, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this was probably 1982, 83, just before there was any research. So I kept very quiet about it. But luckily, I managed to find in grad school a group of people who were like-minded souls, who'd been thinking about this seriously. There was actually a study group of people who were studying meditation and psychotherapy. Luckily, I connected with them. Someone who was more organized than I was actually a community organizer, started this Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy, and we began talking together and teaching together and creating conferences together. And one of my friends and colleagues is Chris Germer, and people may have heard of his work. And he started writing and thinking about self-compassion probably 2004. His book on the mindful path to self-compassion was published in 2009. And he was inspired by the work of Kristen Neff, who I'm sure you all have heard of. And she started doing her research, her really groundbreaking research in 2003. And together they joined forces in 2010 and said, you know, let's merge. So Chris was a clinician, Kristen was a researcher. They were inspired by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And they turned their work into an 8-week course called Mindful Self-Compassion. And Chris knew that I was interested in compassion. We both had a similar background in terms of really devotional practice. And I started teaching mindful self-compassion with Chris from the program's inception and helped fine-tune the practices of the 8-week program. And now I've taught it to hundreds of people and teach and mentor mindful self-compassion. Chris and Kristen have taught it worldwide to tens and thousands of people. So that's one thread here of my work and my love of self-compassion. And one thing I really want to talk about tonight, after having taught it for so long, is that not everyone takes to self-compassion. There are misconceptions, either that it's sappy or it's wimpy, or people find it hard to feel, or it's hard to find the time. Anyone here ever felt that way? Just show of hands that self-compassion, yeah, can be challenging. So just so you know, you're not alone. A lot of people experience this. So what I've tried to do today in the talk is really sequence this to provide some ease and make self-compassion as comfortable and as natural as possible. And for those who feel that it's difficult, the analogy I like is that it's really something we do without thinking about it. Let's say you're cooking dinner. Or let's say I'm cooking dinner and I burn myself. I'm making some spaghetti or something. I'm pouring the pasta into the colander. The pasta splatters and I burn myself. And what do you do when you get splattered by or burnt by hot oil or hot water? You know, you put some cold water on it. You put some ice on it. Maybe you put aloe vera on it. So basically we know what to do. So what I'd like to do is really help you tap into that natural instinct. So when we started with the meditation, we were being held by the earth, nurtured by a tree, and then showered with compassion by beings in our lives who have seen us, who've heard us. And that was the first step. So what I want to do now is do what Rick Hansen, and I assume most people here know of Rick Hansen's work, and if you don't know. He's just a really wonderful, creative, thoughtful, innovative psychologist. And he talks about the importance of installation. So it's really nice to have a sweet meditation experience, but he's found that it doesn't last unless we really install it. So I'm going to lead you in a very short, compassionate body scan. And what's nice about these practices is you don't have to do it for 45 minutes. You can really do it in about 3 or 4 minutes. So let me guide you in a very quick practice. And I like to do what I call quick and dirty practices because so many people have the intention to have deep practices, but it's often hard. So I'd like to start people, especially really busy parents, with practices that are really short and manageable. So let's all do this together. Just start by feeling your feet on the ground, perhaps feeling the sensations in the soles of your feet. Again, letting the ground hold you. And then bringing your awareness up through your feet. Again, noticing sensations, pulsations. Letting the awareness rise from your feet to your ankles. To your calves, your shins. And while you're doing this, not only bringing awareness to the body and sensations, but bringing some gratitude and appreciation to your feet for helping you walk, to your calves, to your knees, for helping you walk, for helping you run, helping you swim. And if you notice any discomfort, it's okay. There's often discomfort in the body. And just see if you can bring a little kindness, perhaps to your knees or your feet. And moving up into your thighs. Your buttocks, again, appreciating all that your body does for you. Your pelvis, your abdomen, your belly, perhaps just letting your belly soften and relax. Often hold a lot of tension in our bellies. Now bringing your awareness up into your back, your chest. You may even like again to put your hand or two hands on your heart. Bringing some warmth, some kindness to ourselves. Maybe even feeling your heartbeat. Often when we get really quiet, we can feel our heart beating or even feel our pulse. Just stop, listen. Just tending to yourself right now. Bringing this compassion to your body. To any place that might be in pain, experiencing discomfort. And gently bringing your attention into your shoulders, upper arms, elbows, lower arms, your hands, just letting your hands relax and soften, perhaps even feeling the tingling in your hands. And then moving up gently, warmly, bringing some kindness into your neck, your throat. Again, other places where we often hold tension, tightness. Bringing some kindness, warmth into your jaw, upper and lower jaw, your cheeks. Letting your eyes soften. Often hold a lot of tension in your eyes, your ears. Again, gratitude for the gift of seeing, the gift of hearing, the gift of seeing and speaking, and then letting your forehead soften. And finally, letting the top of your head and your temples soften. Just feeling that you can really bring this compassion into your body. And then just taking a few deep breaths, perhaps stretching again. And opening your eyes. And now I want to segue into a clinical story. And this story is called Already Broken. And of course, everything has been changed and disguised to protect identities. And Holly was an articulate, intelligent, appealing young woman with enormous potential. Unfortunately, her chronic and severe depression and anxiety made it difficult for her to sustain work or intimate relationships. While she periodically made friends, they soon became exhausted by her demands, and she found herself alone and bereft. Her young and enthusiastic therapist learned every technique she could in her attempt to cure Holly, including psychodynamic therapy, cognitive behavioral interventions, EMDR, I know this sounds like alphabet soup, sensory motor psychotherapy, IFS, internal family systems, over the course of a long and complex treatment. But none of these interventions worked for long. Holly's psychopharmacologist was also young and dedicated and tried giving Holly virtually every antidepressant he knew, as well as some that were off-label. After years of concerted efforts, her treaters felt like they'd become a cross between cheerleaders and samurai warriors in their effort to help Holly have a better life. However, her treatment-resistant depression was really treatment-resistant. "I'm like Humpty Dumpty," Holly said. "I'm just too broken for therapy." After yet another hospitalization, when Holly talked about how broken she was and how broken the world was, her exhausted and no longer young therapist shared a story she'd read about the meditation master Ajahn Chah, teacher of Jack Kornfield's. During a talk, he held up a beautiful crystal goblet that he was drinking from. So just imagine this is a beautiful crystal goblet, which in fact it is. And he said, "You see this goblet? For me, this glass is already broken. I enjoy it. I drink out of it. It holds my water admirably, sometimes even reflecting the sun and the light in beautiful patterns. If I should tap it, it has a lovely ring to it." Imagine a lovely ring. "But when I put this glass on a shelf and the wind knocks it over, don't worry, I won't do it, or my elbow brushes it off the table and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, of course. But when I understand that this glass is already broken, every moment with it is precious." And if people want to read the story, it's in Thoughts Without a Thinker by Mark Epstein. So Ajahn Chah wasn't just speaking about the glass, the body, our world, or the inevitability of death. He was also speaking to us about the nature of the self that we take to be so real, he was saying, is already broken. And yet, it is beautiful and it is precious. Holly experienced an empathic resonance and her eyes filled with tears. "Finally, after all these years, you got it. This is what I've been trying to tell you over and over and over. You didn't believe me. I'm broken. And you needed a Buddhist monk to listen? What is wrong with you?" Holly and her therapist sat in stillness for a while. "You're right," the therapist responded after a long silence. "I didn't get it. I understand that now. I was trying so hard to fix you or cure you, and I can't. And I do care deeply about you." And this marked a turning point in the treatment. Holly looked stunned. "You know what? When you said that, I realized that no one ever, not my father or my mother or my brother, ever admitted that they weren't right. No one ever admitted that they were fallible. And that means a lot to me." And once Holly felt seen, heard, acknowledged, things began to shift. She was someone who was very hard on herself. She called herself an alien, a loser, worthless, the scum of the earth. There was virtually no self-compassion at that point. Slowly, oh so slowly, it felt like geological time, she began to let in just a little bit of compassion. And as psychologist Carl Rogers said, "The curious paradox of life is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change." And again, in what seemed like geological time, Holly could practice being just a little kinder to herself. And like so many people, about 75% of us, she could be kind and compassionate to a friend, but not to herself. She began to include herself in the circle of care. While Holly still struggled with depression, she no longer felt so profoundly alone during her depressive episodes. Her caregivers had stayed with her over the long haul and were delighted as she began to find contentment and balance in midlife. The following prayer from Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition speaks to the immense power of listening. And it's addressed to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. But feel free, as I read it, to think about any compassionate being that you like. We evoke your name, Avalokiteshvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in this world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We evoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what is being said as well as what is being left unsaid. For we know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering. And in this deep listening, and I've been listening to Tara Brach's Radical Compassion Challenge the past few days. I'm sure other people have been listening as well. And she said something that really stayed with me. And she said, your heart can become a transformer of sorrows. And speaking of sorrows, a dear friend of mine died just a few days ago. She was a brilliant, vital, and fierce woman, a professor of Spanish at Georgetown, and had lived in D.C. for many years before moving back to Boston. In fact, her obit was just in the Washington Post this weekend. And she was diagnosed with cancer at 19, struggled with surgery after surgery, chemo after chemo, and finally at 61, she'd had enough of being in and out of the emergency room. I'm at peace with dying, she told me in her last email. But I wasn't at peace with losing her. I went on a winter retreat called Inner Light at the Dark of the Year, and I sat with my grief at her imminent death. At one point during the walking meditation, I went outside. It was toward the end of the day, and the light was falling. A dark, snowy, frigid New England day. My mind had become quieter after hours of meditation. On the last walk of the day, I saw something I hadn't noticed in my previous walks. Right in front of me was a tree branch full of drops of water. These teardrops were radiant, full of light, sparkling. I stopped and I looked. It was as if the tree spoke to me. Even here, In this darkness, there is light. There is beauty. And this teaching of how sadness can connect you with life was beautifully articulated by Kobayashi Isa, the Japanese poet who wrote about 200 years ago. Everything passes, and in that lies the world's beauty. When Isa wrote the following haiku, he'd seen his mother die when he was 2. A stepmother arrived, quote, whip him 100 times a day. He nursed his father through the death of typhoid fever. And then after years of poverty and solitude, he married at 51. His first son died after a month. A second son also died within a month. He had a daughter and watched with pride as she began to grow and shine. And then at 1, she contracted smallpox and died. Isa had studied Buddhism. He knew about change. He knew about impermanence. And when he lost this little girl, he wrote this gasp of a haiku. This world of dew is a world of dew. And yet, I'll say that again because I know it took me a while to really get it. This world of dew is a world of dew. And yet. And we often want sadness to go away. We want to try to keep what is pleasant, what is happy. The teacher Pema Chodron was asked how to live with sadness, and she responded, sad is good. Let sadness be a connector for you with humanity. Life has joy and sadness. Life has hard times, and life has beautiful times. It's a complete picture, and you can't live a human life without all those painful parts and just have the pleasant parts. That's never going to happen. Everyone tries, and it never happens. They keep trying anyway. The fact that something hurts and you feel sad, think of that as actually good. Think of that as growth. And sometimes this is what growth feels like. And I recently read a story from the Zen teacher Koshin Paley Ellison, and he runs a contemplative Zen center in New York for people who are dying. And he spoke of how a while ago, scientists created a miniature biosphere project. They created lakes and marshes, forest and desert, nearly 4,000 species of animals. But the trees didn't do well. They wouldn't grow straight. The scientists found that it was because there was no resistance in the biosphere. No storms, no winds, no extremes of temperature, which are the things that give the tree its resilience. These are the things that strengthen the core of the tree. The word that scientists use is heartwood. What a metaphor. So I looked it up because I didn't know what heartwood was, and it's the dense innermost part of the tree. So the challenge I want to leave you with is can we begin to understand the importance of the winds in our life? Rather than pushing them away, can they become part of our meditation? And the Buddha says, I'm sure you know, speak of the 8 worldly winds. And we may want to see that they actually help us grow. We may not see that at the time. Just like the winds strengthen the tree, the winds can strengthen us. So wrapping up here, can we use the winds to connect with the suffering of others? Because we're all blown and often literally blown over. Can we even welcome the winds? Can we see the wind as our teacher as well? So coming full circle here, we started with being welcomed in this room by the beings in this room, held by the earth, received by the earth. We then installed the compassion and acceptance and love in our bodies. In the clinical story I gave, we looked at the barriers to letting compassion in. And the barriers, the resistance, is often rooted, didn't mean for that pun, sorry, in our family of origin and messages from the culture. And the question is, how can we shift and open to compassion and self-compassion? And it's by listening deeply, by seeing the complexity, and not just what we want to see. So opening to the deep wounds, the sadness, to the grief, and not pushing it away, as Tara's been saying in her radical compassion challenge, where does it hurt? It's really reflecting on where does it hurt. And as the poet Issa models, we can see both the sadness and the beauty. So I want to end with something that hopefully will pull all these threads together, or at least somewhat together. And this was from an article in the New York Times. I can give you the reference at the end. And it was published just a few months ago in September. And some scientists with very, very sensitive instruments listened to the earth, recording the sounds. And this was done at Castleton Tower. And with these very sensitive instruments, they heard the pulse of a sandstone tower. And what the Times article said, and you would think I was just being poetic or mystical, but this was like a science reporter, wrote that it pulsates at the rate of a human heartbeat, which is pretty amazing when we think that the earth, that rock, has a pulse, has a heartbeat. So in the last minute or so, I've asked just to play a minute or so of the sound of the heartbeat of this rock. And the way I like to listen to it, and feel free to listen any way you like, is to close my eyes and just put my hands on the heart and listen deeply. And I'll give you all the reference, and you can go home and listen to the full 3 minutes of it. So it's going to be a little quiet, but we'll do the best we can.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming. And let yourself be held by the heartbeat and the heart of the earth. Namaste.